Reality used to seem simple, but then came the assault, an unending stream of fake news, alternative facts, and lies disguised as truths. Now Americans can't even agree on what's a fact anymore, let alone what's real. Reality, according to On the Media's Brooke Gladstone, was never what one might think. There is and always has been a bubble. People are subjective and prey to stereotypes, which makes reality more vulnerable than ever imagined. Enter Donald Trump and his team of advisors. For them, as she writes in her new book, The Trouble with Reality, lying is the point. The more blatant the lie, the easier it is to hijack reality and assert power over the truth. Brooke Gladstone is a Peabody Award-winning journalist and co-host and managing editor of On the Media, heard Thursday evenings right here on WAMC at 10 p.m. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Brooke Gladstone back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a delight to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
The subtitle to this work is A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. When did you start ruminating?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people, maybe more than half the country, who felt something more than just a political defeat or a sense of discomfort or concern. There was a kind of icy hand gripping the viscera among many people to the point where we're working on a book on a different subject, and the publisher and agent came to the office and said, we need something right now to address what so many people are feeling. Not everybody. Everybody is feeling a sense of dislocation. Some are kind of enjoying it, and others are feeling a profound degree of distress like they haven't felt before. So I decided to do a kind of two-week deep dive, a kind of fever dream, and write an essay. And that's basically what the trouble with reality is. It's an essay which first tries to put this moment in a kind of historical and philosophical and neurochemical context, and then talk about how the rhetorical methods of Donald Trump took advantage of a particular moment, the advantage of the fact that we are all ever more isolated in our bubbles, which is not just an issue of the media, although people love to say that, we always have been. And then finally, if you are feeling distress, it's not really a prescription, it isn't necessarily a consolation, but hopefully the explanation can point you to some areas where you might find a little relief from strain.
Robin Williams famously said, reality, what a concept. So as a baseline, as we begin our conversation, what do you think we need to know about reality and what it is?
Reality, well, obviously there are all kinds of reality. The reality that I am referring to is not the reality that, say, Philip K. Dick was asked about many times. He was asked, what is reality? Because he was such a brilliant science fiction writer and such a brilliant creator and annihilator of realities in the fictional realm, right? So he found that even after decades and 30 novels, he couldn't come up with a good answer to what reality was. And then some graduate student asked him, and he just said, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. And that would refer to a kind of objective reality. But the kind of reality that I'm talking about is not a unitary thing, but an infinitely split thing, a handcrafted, bespoke thing that we each make for ourselves, which is a combination of the observed world, facts, basically things we see, and all the things we don't see. A mixture of the seen and the unseen. That is to say, you take some hard information, you marinate it in values and tradition and history and narrative and community, and you end up crafting a reality that may look nothing like somebody else's reality. And we have to do this. We cannot live in the world as it is. It is too complex. We are wired, we are constructed, we are biological creatures that are created to filter out information that isn't immediately relevant to us, that won't make us feel better, and that won't enable us to move comfortably through the world. So we are more engaged in directing unwelcome information away than we are in integrating information into our world. We need our universes to be secure. And so given that we are wired that way, that the media increasingly enable us to do this seamlessly without ever encountering stuff we don't want to see, how stereotypes are not just reinforced in our own lives, but endlessly in the media sphere, because there is a sense of disaffection in the country that is actually far different from the picture that is painted by Donald J. Trump. I mean, people feel terrible anxiety. People feel a horrible sense of loss. But is it based on rising crime rates? Absolutely not. Crime rates have never been lower. Right. He always cites a handful of cities where that's not the case, but overall, never been lower. Immigration. He's always taught, we know how he feels about the Mexicans. We haven't been engaged for a long time in almost zero immigration. That is to say, as many people come from Mexico as leave, leaving the number absolutely flat. So here are two tent poles of that philosophy that objective reality says simply aren't true, but it doesn't matter because it helps reaffirm a worldview and help explain the anxiety that comes from something other than what he's talking about. Facts no longer serve to reinforce our realities.
You write early in the book, to ease the transition from the world within to the world out there, cast one last look inward and consider that, after all, we are what we eat. How so?
Well, I mean, we have to consider clearly, what do we consume? And if we're, you know, I mean, we all know that we like to consume what is in our bubbles. We like to consume material, news, entertainment that basically is designed to reinforce our notions of the world. When our worlds collide and when they smash and crash, it is a sickening feeling. We live in gated universes, and we don't like people who threaten that. Now, in that chapter you were talking about, I quoted at length Neil Postman, who issued what I called the most impassioned, incisive warning label on our media diet. And to illustrate it, he compared two pivotal works of dystopian fiction, George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Do you want me to read any of that?
That would be great. Thank you.
Basically, what he's saying is that in Orwell's vision, we are crushed by a merciless oppression imposed by others, whereas in Huxley's vision, we are seduced, sedated, and satiated. We basically enslave ourselves. What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book because there'd be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Essentially, Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us, and Huxley feared that the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell thought people were controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they're controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us.
What does it say about us as Americans and a culture that following the election, so many of us went to Orwell to read and Handmaid's Tale too, to read and to draw those comparisons?
What do you think, Joe? I would say it's because it is much more comforting to assume that the principal threat to our well-being comes from outside rather than long ingrained and wired in habits that we can't see or identify because they are so much a part of how we construct our worlds. You know, I wrote another book back in 2011. I kind of emptied my brain into a glorified comic book history of the media and a treatise called The Influencing Machine. And in it, the last line is, we get the media we deserve. I think to some degree, we've gotten the politics we deserve. We haven't been paying attention to what we need to pay attention to. And basically what I suggest isn't that we go out and we find common ground and hands across the sea. I mean, I'm not naive. I don't want to, nor do I expect anybody else to sacrifice their values, their fundamental beliefs, or any of that. I do think, however, that we at least have to see what else is happening out there. If we can't see through other people's eyes, at least hear what they have to say. Because if we don't, we will never be able to reconstruct our realities any more durably than we have thus far. Every once in a while in history, on the great information highway of our individual realities, there's a huge multi-reality smash-up, and the debris goes flying everywhere. And basically, you're going to have to start tweaking and rebuilding, or you'll never be able to escape that sickening feeling, because you'll never be able to understand how it happened.
Brooke Gladstone is co-host of On the Media. She is also the author of the new book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. So to throw back something that you just said, which is the last line of your book, The Influencing Machine, of we get the media that we deserve. Do we have the media that we deserve right now?
You know, we do. And one thing, if there is one positive aspect to all of this, I think people are finally understanding that if they want high quality, reliable information from people who are people who make mistakes, but who they fundamentally trust to be honest with them and to be fair, then they have to pay for it, which is why the New York Times is doing better than it ever has. And the Washington Post is getting more subscribers, and public radio is having a pretty good pledge season among those stations that are having it, because people realize, you know, this does serve a purpose. We need to have the information coming, and it won't be for free. I mean, they've seen over the last 20 years how the fundamental business models of commercial news has broken. Advertising drops. Craigslist took away sometimes half the budgets that were derived in newspapers from classified ads and so on. People stopped subscribing because they could get stuff online, and now they realized finally that the old saying, you know, information wants to be free, doesn't mean that information is supposed to be without cost. Only that it is supposed to be unfettered. So that's good, but the question is how do you get people to partake as they did many, many years ago from a relatively mutual, common, shared set of facts? How do you get them to draw from a common pool of information? Because if you can't, then you can't negotiate. And if you can't negotiate, then you can't have democracy. And I honestly think that that's the second thing that causes some people to sit bolt upright in the middle of the night. Democracy, a fundamental, foundational principle of many people's universes, the fact that the system itself was so good that it didn't matter who actually pulled the levers or who inhabited the system was solid and the system would endure. I think people are starting to have their doubts about that. And that is something that's bound to make somebody a bit nauseous.
The second to the last chapter in the book is entitled Recovering Reality. So how do we recover? Because as you point out in the book, you write the line, American history is pocked with fervent battles and brawls over what is true. But you also say that we are at a very unique moment right now.
Yes, we are. And partly it's because we have these separate streams of information. Partly because he has a constituency that is waiting to see whether or not the compromise that every person makes when they vote for a candidate, no matter who that candidate is. But in this case, the Trump voter is waiting to see whether Trump will deliver on his promises. And we have to wait for that moment. But I think that even more important, and we hear this word thrown around a lot, Trump fulfills the four criteria that James Fenimore Cooper once devised to identify a demagogue. And a demagogue speaks above the heads of established institutions to people who don't feel that they've been served by those institutions. And they essentially say that, you know, you just go along with me, whether I say the truth or whether I don't say the truth, it's not relevant. How does that affect your life? Just go along with me and I will reaffirm your view of the world and I will help and I will understand. And you can find a little bit of redemption here, which your own leaders in the system that you live under has not provided. Basically, there are a lot of people who felt so desperate, they were happy to blow the system up. And I think the rest of the country was frankly shocked and still hasn't come over it, because he's still blowing things up and nobody's stopping him.
So you do, at the end of that chapter, say that there is a the part of the book that actually can make you feel a little bit better, and which is telling us that action, and meaningful action in particular, is a good treatment. It's time-tested for moral panic.
Well, for most people, action is better than staying curled up in the fetal position. I mean, nothing changes then. If you act, then at least it gives you the feeling you have some control over your environment. No matter how small it is, you can react against it. And we know very well that phone calls to representatives are tallied. They make a difference. Not so much emails, by the way. It's not easy to act. Making a phone call is more work than signing on to an email. But the emails don't have the impact of phone calls. So if you care about a policy, then make a phone call. Show up. That has an impact. The fact is the people who are allowing Trump to break things are answerable to us, as ultimately is Trump. And if we're okay with things being broken, then if you think that in the end it'll work out better for you, then don't do anything. If you're worried about the norms of, you know, ethics and conflict of interest and the kinds of values that say, you know, people should have some access to health care at a price that they can afford, that kind of thing. If you see that, those kinds of things as fundamental values, then you have to put some skin in the game. And that will make you feel better. And the rest, you know, and the rest will watch and see what happens next.
You do have a line at the end of the book where you say it is possible that after just a few bad years, all this horror, the terrible mystery of it, will slowly sink beneath our carefully curated horizons from whence it came. There still is, and I agree with that entirely. I do wonder, though, we're looking at things that are being done that are, or at least seem to be, irreparable, though, right?
Nothing is irreparable, but it will leave a great deal of damage. I mean, you know, after a forest fire, those trees will never come back, right? You have to allow a new growth. There'll be some construction. There's another great, you know, cliche. You can't stand in the same river twice. You know, that's right. Just the onrush of history. This is a historical moment, as people love to say, you know, interesting times. But it is a time when being a citizen means something. It needs to be reconsidered. It needs to be pondered. Our complacency has been shredded and shrapneled along with some of the foundational principles on which we each constructed our worlds. So, you know, it's what Homer Simpson would call a crisertunity.
Well, I think of no better place to end than quoting Homer Simpson. The new book is The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. It is published by Workman. Brooke Gladstone is the co-host and managing editor of On the Media. Brooke, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
You're welcome, Joe.
Again, the name of the book is The Trouble with Reality. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.